Welcome to If Then, the show about how technology is changing our lives and our future. I'm April Glazer.
And I'm Will Oremus.
Hey everyone, welcome to If Then. We're coming to you from Slate and Future Tense, a partnership between Slate, Arizona State University, and New America. We are recording this on the afternoon of Tuesday, March 26th.
On today's show, we'll discuss the latest news from Apple, which held a launch event this week. Not for a new iPhone, but for a big new push into TV, gaming, and the news. There's even an Apple credit card now. We'll talk about what it all means. Then April will give us a quick update on the Democratic effort to restore net neutrality and the hurdles that lie ahead.
After that, we'll have a chat with Vina Dubal, a law professor at UC Hastings here in the Bay Area. We'll talk to her about how hundreds of Uber and Lyft drivers went on strike yesterday across California ahead of both companies planning major multi-billion dollar IPOs. We'll also discuss a California lawsuit that impacts freelance and contract workers, forcing many of them to be reclassified as employees, and a bunch of other stuff on the topic. It's a really complex thing. I'm excited to have Vina with us.
And as always, we'll end with Don't Close My Tabs, some of the best stuff we saw online this week. That's all coming up on If Then.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Okay, so, Will, you sat through the entire Apple event yesterday, right?
I did.
Or you, like, watched it online, I assume. You didn't go to Cupertino.
I did not. There was a parade of announcements and a parade of celebrities at the end. We had Spielberg. We had Reese Witherspoon and Jennifer Aniston and Steve Carell. We had
Oprah.
Oprah shouting right? Apple at the end, which was a nice touch, really. It was long, and there were no devices announced, and that's kind of what's interesting about it.
Oh yeah, so that's super rare. Like, these events usually are pretty hardware centric because Apple is pretty much primarily a hardware company, right?
Right. So in the past, Apple has made hardware and then it has made software to run on that hardware.
Yeah.
And a big secret to the company's success, obviously, has been that the software and the hardware work together seamlessly. And it's this nice, clean, closed ecosystem where Apple controls everything. So it would have events to launch new devices like iPhones and iPads. It would have other events often in the spring to launch a new operating system, like a new version of iOS and macOS. But now we got a new type of event, and this event was centered on what Tim Cook calls services.
Right. No, and now the idea with moving into services is that everybody already has an iPhone and a Apple computer. So how are they going to make money now? I mean, they've actually seen plateaus in sales when it comes to iPhones, right? And to be clear, these iPhones now cost like about $1,000, at least the nicest ones. So, you know, people are just not buying a new one every time there's a new one out anymore, perhaps. But the sales have slowed. And so now the next place they're trying to, you know, take all our money is through these kinds of subscription-based services. And those, a number of those were unveiled on Monday. Can you talk us through some of the new things that Apple's going to, or maybe tweaked things, but kind of these services that Apple's going to be providing?
Yeah, so they sort of spent the past 10 years trying to come up with what's the next iPhone, like what's the next device that's going
right.
to carry Apple for another decade, and they never quite found it.
And it was the AirPods, right? That was it. It was that everyone will keep losing them, and so they'll keep buying them.
I know you hate the AirPods, and you think they look like earrings.
No, they're good. People like them. I just don't want them for myself, but it turns out that the obsolescence in those is not carrying over. It's not enough to carry the torch of the iPhone, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think the AirPods have a lot of potential, but they're not on the same level as the iPhone in terms of expense.
People aren't losing them as quickly as I thought they would.
Maybe not.
So anyway, what's on the table now?
Yes, so having failed to come up with the new killer hardware, they are shifting towards services. And these services that were announced this week include a new version of Apple News. It's called Apple News Plus. And the idea is you pay Apple $9.99 a month and you get access to like some 300 different magazines, some of which you would normally have to have your a separate subscription for. They'll look nice, you know, fancy fonts, maybe some interactive stuff in the Apple News app. You will also get two major newspapers, access to content from the Wall Street Journal and Los Angeles Times, a few other digital offerings. But basically, this is Apple bought a startup called Texture a few years ago that did something similar. It would bundle a bunch of different magazine subscriptions together in one app. This is what that turned into. And Apple is hoping that you'll pay this extra fee to read, you know, whatever your favorite magazines are within Apple News. And in fact, if you bought the subscription, it's actually cheaper than buying a subscription to just one or two of the many different publications that are contained within it. So as long as you don't mind reading magazines in Apple News, it could be a good deal for you. But that's just the start. There's also Apple TV Plus, and that the details there are fuzzy, but basically it seems like Apple wants to start competing to some degree with Netflix and Amazon Prime, and it's rolling out its own TV shows, and that was hence the parade of Hollywood figureheads at the end of the event. And then Apple Arcade is a subscription gaming service where you'll get access to a whole bunch of games for one monthly price. Again, we don't know the price on either the gaming or the TV service. And then one more thing Apple announced this week is Apple Card, which is a credit card. It works with Apple Pay and Apple Wallet. MasterCard will actually do the payment processing. So it's not like, and Goldman Sachs is a partner as well. So Apple isn't becoming a bank, but it's sort of like a souped up version of a rewards card. You'll get cash back in Apple Wallet and Apple Pay for stuff that you buy.
Of course, I have questions and thoughts on all of these, but most of my questions are about the news because that's the business I'm in. You know, I read your article. You had a great piece on this that I recommend people read, that kind of walk through the potential pitfalls or how this might work on Slate. It's called Apple is Reinventing Itself as the Ultimate Middleman. And you mentioned there that Apple says that all of the subscriptions that it offers for $10 a month would be $8,000 individually or something. Is that what it was?
Yeah, this is, if you subscribe to 300 magazines and you're paying $8,000 a month, you should definitely take this deal. You'll save $7,990 a month.
I love that figure because I want to meet somebody who's like, oh, thank goodness.
There was a little bit of infomercial vibe when they were like, for the low monthly price of $9.99, you will get all of these things.
I know. That's not it. I thought I got that vibe too. But you know, that Apple is getting more into the news game is something that you've actually thought and written quite a bit about. I mean, Apple News is already a behemoth in its own right, but it hasn't necessarily treated publishers or really monetized in a way for, or been profitable for publishers or kind of helped us sustain our business, even though it's brought a lot of traffic. And so obviously I'm a little skeptical about this new deal. Can you kind of let me know if this, you think this will work, or what some pitfalls might be, or concerns, or maybe this is potentially great? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think Apple was hoping that this would be something bigger. Apple News is a pretty successful product in terms of people using it. People seem to like it. A lot of people are getting their news on there. The readership is growing quickly. But you're right. They have had a lot of trouble selling ads on there, and the publishers who put their stories on there are not seeing much money from it. And when Apple went out to recruit publishers for this Apple News Plus product, it apparently, according to some good reporting from the Wall Street Journal and others, it apparently ran into a lot of skepticism. And so you'll notice that the New York Times is not part of Apple News Plus. The Washington Post is not part of Apple News Plus. Apple was reportedly asking for a 50% cut of the revenues from all subscriptions. The Times and the Washington Post have thriving subscription businesses, so they just said no. And you know, maybe they'll get on board later. Maybe Apple will lower its asking price. But it seems to be treating news publishers a lot like it treated the record labels when it pushed out iTunes, or the way it treated book publishers when it came out with books. It's just squeezing them. It's using all the leverage it has and trying to get the best deal, because it used to be that Apple just made nice software as a sort of loss leader for the phones, for the hardware, and they would make all the money on the hardware. But now that they have to grow the services business, they have to sort of grab all the money they can. And so not just in news, but in TV and gaming and payments, they're looking for every possible way to take a cut of this new, I'm calling it like the subscription economy. There's this sort of like new trend of people finally paying for content online. And Apple, it seems like, wants to be the broker of that economy in a way that I think is analogous to how Amazon has become the broker of the online retail
right.
economy and e-commerce.
You know, and what gives me pause here is that, you know, you brought up Apple Music and iTunes, and really the kind of deal that they forced on people was that, okay, if you want access to people that have iPhones, then you have to take our bad bargain. You know, like they kind of use their gatekeeping power in many ways, or not necessarily that severe, but they basically are able to kind of wave this very, very big bargaining chip and throw it down and say, you know, well, we have access to everyone with iPhones. And that doesn't seem to be working out, you know, as well or as clearly in this case. But Apple has a lot of gatekeeping power. And so as they move into the services business, it's going to be really interesting to see how they leverage their access to their massive, you could think of it as a user base. I would have, you know, I would prefer to think of people who have iPhones as just owners. But, you know, they're also, I guess, a user base.
Right. So this is Apple sees this as an opportunity to get you to not only pay $1,000 every 2 years for a new iPhone, but to also pay, you know, $10, $20, $30 a month in subscriptions for the various content that you use on that phone. And they are well positioned to do it. I mean, if anybody can do it, it's this company that has a really intimate relationship with their customers. They know that Apple customers like convenience and ease of use. They know how to design customer software that their customers like. And so they're betting mm-hmm. that a lot of iPhone users will say, hey, look, you know, I could go out and look for the best bundle of different third-party games that I could buy, or I could just take what Apple's putting right here in front of me. And they say they've picked out some good ones, you know, some games or some TV shows. So let's just give that a try. And they've had a lot of success with Apple Music, even though Spotify was already an established player and Apple Music was basically a ripoff of Spotify. It has worked because, yeah. you know, a lot of Apple users will just take whatever Apple offers. They have disposable income. And so I think that's what Apple's betting on here. The one other thing I want to add, though, is that Apple has one other real virtue going for it besides the sort of convenience and seamlessness for people who have iPhones. It has really been marketing itself as the privacy-focused tech company. And it's pushing that pretty hard with these products. It's saying that with Apple News Plus, it will not track what you read. It will not serve you targeted advertisements based on your behavior. It's not building a profile of you. Apple also says that with the credit card, it won't track what you buy and where. A lot of people don't realize it, but your credit card company is almost certainly tracking all your purchases and using it to help inform this behavioral profile of you. Apple says it won't do those things. And that I think, you know, there is debate out there about how much people really care about privacy. But I think that will help nudge some people toward choosing Apple as their way into these different types of content and services.
And I mean, I want to wrap this conversation, but just in the case of the credit card, it's interesting to me that they say they're not going to track that because I don't even know how that's possible. Or it's like, they're just not going to be a record of what I purchase because, I mean, the whole thing is like when you're using your credit card, there's a record of what you purchase. So I think that's an interesting claim. I need to read more about the kind of the mechanics of that to really wrap my head around some of the privacy claims that I'm broadly understanding go with the Apple card. But I want to move on to talk briefly about net neutrality if we have a couple minutes.
Yeah, April, you have continued to doggedly follow the battle to restore net neutrality. What's the latest on that front?
Yeah, so today there was a markup, which it's kind of like a vote type of situation in the House Subcommittee on Communications and Technology on a bill that would restore the open internet rules, the net neutrality rules that were repealed under Chairman Ajit Pai at the FCC in 2018. This bill would kind of once again make it illegal for internet providers like Comcast and Verizon and AT&T to block access to websites or throttle websites, or to charge websites a fee to reach users at faster speeds. And so, you know, making it out of this subcommittee is kind of a big deal because the way it was made out, it turns out that there were not amendments that were tagged on with it. There was a huge fear that, you know, Republican lawmakers particularly, but just that someone would be successful in tacking on an amendment that would water it down. And, the fear with passing any sort of legislation when a regulatory agency usually takes care of something is that the legislation could be worse or could codify kind of like loopholes or a watered down version of, net neutrality rules that have concessions into law. And then we would kind of be worse off. Whereas with a regulatory agency, there's more flexibility, or it's a bit easier to promulgate policy changes than it is through Congress. But, the Save the Internet Act went through with this subcommittee, and that's a good sign. I mean, it's going to be a bit harder to get something through the Senate where there is a Republican majority. But, tens of thousands of people tuned in to this, like, live stream committee markup hearing today. It's this kind of obscure, moment in civics that people don't typically tune into. And so, people are still charged up on this, and rightfully so, really concerned about how much power the people that they pay every month for internet will have to control the websites that they access. So this is an issue that's moving along, and we're waiting for a court decision now, but it's also now moving through Congress. So I just wanted to give an update on that because it is, another milestone in this ongoing saga.
All right, I'll continue to read your reporting on that.
When we come back, we will have an interview with Vina Dubal. She's a professor of law at UC Hastings, and she's going to talk to us about the gig economy and how workers fare now and the upcoming IPOs with Uber and Lyft and the kind of battle as to whether or not people who work for these companies as drivers or delivery people and what have you should be classified as employees.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank, USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Our guest today is Vina Dubal, Associate Professor of Law at UC Hastings, who specializes in labor as it pertains to the ever-growing gig-centric workforce. Vina, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with the news a bit. Hundreds of drivers staged a strike across California yesterday. These are drivers for Uber and Lyft. What were they striking over exactly? I know there are a lot of reasons for there to be grievances, but there were a few specific things this time, right?
So the drivers in Los Angeles were what sort of precipitated the strike was specifically a 25-cent cut in their pay. But the drivers that were up protesting in San Francisco were protesting both pay and a number of other things, including policies around their deactivation and termination, the fact that Lyft is about to, and Uber for that matter, are on the verge of an IPO, and they feel that the model isn't profitable, that it's certainly not profitable for them, and that there are just certain things that need to change before the companies take those huge steps. I think that, I spoke with a number of drivers who are also protesting things more broadly in addition to pay and the precarity of their, living in fear of constant termination. I talked to drivers who were angry that their data was being constantly recorded by Uber, that they had no access to that data, that in general folks feel like they are that they are working for this behemoth company that they have no control over anything. And so I think that's what instigated a lot of the anger.
And that's it's interesting you say they have no control over anything, because the whole kind of situation of their workforce is premised that they have control, that they're contract workers, right? And so maybe you can kind of explain to us, first of all, how many contract workers there are, or gig workers, and what exactly we mean when we say a gig worker or an independent contractor that works for these kinds of app-based platforms.
So whether or not someone is an independent contractor is actually a legal inquiry. But what's happened with the Uber and Lyft and Handy and DoorDash and the whole what we now term the technologically enabled gig economy is that the companies themselves have created a political and cultural notion of what it means to be a contractor that actually doesn't line up with legal definitions of contractor. And in the companies making, these are people who are, quote unquote, their own boss, who have the flexibility to work when they want to, if they want to, and are therefore somehow free. What an independent contractor is under the law is really something very different. It's someone who has control over the day-to-day business that they run. They should have control over things like how much they charge. They should have control over themselves in the workplace. And in stark contrast, in what we call the gig economy, workers are controlled by their app. They're controlled by text messages. They're controlled by algorithms. And they don't get any input into how much they charge, into how much money they make. They have no say in business decisions. They're sort of like actually quite opposite of a contractor. I almost feel like they're a second class employee. You know, they're working for a boss, but unlike in a traditional workplace where you actually can see the boss and to some extent negotiate with the boss on an everyday level, these workers have no control over anything. They have no way to contact anyone. They have no way to offer input into their own work, or into much less into the company's practices. In terms of how many independent contractors there are, it's not as significant as we once thought it would be. The Bureau of Labor Statistics suggests that that the vast majority of workers in the economy are traditional employees. But I think that part of why these contractors, the gig workers, get so much attention both in the labor world and in the media and academia is because they represent what could be, right? They represent the growth of the informal economy in the United States. They represent what labor standards could very easily fall to for the rest of us who are normal employees.
Right. And not just what it could be, but often people have to take these jobs as a side job because their current employment situation isn't good enough. So public education, when it comes to teachers, for example, I have two or three friends who are teachers who drive for Uber or Lyft here and there because their current employment situation is just not sustainable in the housing markets that they are working in.
It's so true, especially in urban areas like San Francisco and Los Angeles, where people are not making enough money off of their full-time job to survive in really expensive areas. This work is it solves for other pathologies, right? Like when people are not able to meet rent and put food on the table, they have to pick up this kind of work. It's a really, really important point.
Yeah, a term you've used that I find interesting is precarity and the precariat, which is a portmanteau of precarious and proletariat. It's like an emerging class of people who work but don't have the kind of security that one would hope for from that work. But I wanted to ask a little bit about the history. I mean, the gig economy, as we talk about it in those terms, is relatively new and has to do with the use of apps to provide services on demand. But what's the relationship between that and earlier forms of temporary work? I mean, in the 50s and 60s, there was Kelly Girl, right? And there's manpower, temp staffing. Are the people participating in today's gig economy, in what ways might they be better off or worse off than people who have been temporary workers under previous sort of labor regimes?
Yeah, so there is a distinction to be drawn between temporary workers and contractors. Temp workers oftentimes have traditional employment protections via their staffing agencies, but the contractor phenomenon does date back to back to the late 50s, 60s, and 70s, when you had a small percentage of people in certain industries, like the janitorial industry, the taxi industry, and the construction industry, who were classified as contractors by their employers, and who, you know, worked very precariously. The difference between them and what we see now in the tech-enabled gig economy, people working on these labor platforms, I think two things. One, just numerically, what the labor platforms do is they enable more and more and more and more people to work in this type of environment. So people who are, especially people who are carved out of wage labor, who don't have access to other types of full-time work because of language barriers, because of, you know, emotional physical disabilities, because of racism, for all these, you know, all these myriad of reasons, the barriers are much lower for them to log onto an app and work. The second thing that's different that makes it, I think, you know, in addition to the growth factor that makes it actually quite qualitatively different is, again, the use of these algorithms for management. So unlike with a taxi driver who was, you know, maybe an independent contractor in the late 1970s who would go into the garage and you know, be able to talk to his fellow workers and interact with a manager and, you know, have some kind of control over aspects of his work, these people, workers in the gig economy, literally are just managed through algorithms. And so it is, I think, an extraordinarily frustrating experience to get a text message that says you're driving too fast, or to get an alert that says that if you just drive a little longer and a little bit more, then maybe you can make more money. Or if you don't pick up, if your rating drops too low, then you're going to be terminated. And to not be able to have like a human face to then interact with, to negotiate, to protest, to say, you know, this is wrong. This information is incorrect. You know, a lot of times drivers say that they're underpaid, and the process to get, you can't just walk into someone's office and say, hey, I think that you left off $100 from my pay stub. You have to go through this annoying process of texting and emailing into the ether, and and the fact that the interface is what's, the technological interface is what's responding to you is, I think, a huge source of anomie and frustration and isolation.
I really like the term, or not like, but I find it useful, the idea of being managed by an algorithm, because it's just so frustrating, the idea of that. And really, they do kind of control people's hours in so many ways. I interviewed a couple of drivers who were striking both in Los Angeles and San Francisco yesterday, and they said that there are all of these programs to incentivize them to stay in the car for hours and hours longer, to kind of control their hours in these kind of small ways that they get these text messages and messages that tell them to keep going and keep going and keep working. One thing I want to bring up, though, is that being managed by an algorithm has been tremendously profitable for these companies, and that they have very little overhead and few kind of managerial responsibilities or responsibilities that a traditional manager and kind of employer would have. The Uber IPO is being pitched to bankers at $120 billion, and the Lyft public offering is being pitched at $23 billion. So this is just, you know, tremendous amounts of money here. And they're also pouring money into campaigns to kind of prevent their worker status, or the status of the people that work for them, from being compromised out of their favor, or out of the favor of these companies. And in particular, we've seen that play out in really interesting ways in California with the Dynamex case. And that's actually a court case that's now being moved to be codified into legislation. I'm going to stop talking. Maybe you can explain what Dynamex is better than me. But it regards how gig workers are classified and whether or not they actually should be classified as employees rather than as independent contractors.
Right. So in California, in mid-2018, the California Supreme Court decided a case, Dynamics v. Superior Court of Los Angeles, that interestingly was about the status of a on-demand transportation delivery company called Dynamics and how they were misclassifying their drivers. And what the California Supreme Court did was use this decision to change the definition of what an employee is in California for the purposes of wage laws, not for unemployment insurance, not for workers' compensation, but just for wage laws. And the Supreme Court said, I think in a really breathtakingly beautiful opinion, that there are people right now who are working in California who have a boss. They're working for big companies, but they're mislabeled contractors. It's hard for them to get their day in court to be officially recognized as employees. And so we're going to make it easier for the people. Instead of making it easy for the company to misclassify them, we're going to presume that everyone is an employee for wage purposes. And it, actually, the company has to prove that no, our workers are actually independent contractors. And the key aspect of the test is that if the worker does what the hiring entity does, then they are an employee. So the example the court gave was, you know, if a plumber is hired by a department store that sells clothes, the plumber is not doing what the department store does. The plumber is fixing the plumbing, the department store sells clothes. And I think the analogy can be extended to say, well, an Uber driver is driving for Uber. They're doing, you know, they're essentially doing chauffeur work, they're doing taxi work, and Uber is a transportation company under California CPUC rules. And so understandably, these companies are very, very worried and upset because what this decision, which has yet to be enforced in the state, although it is the current state of the law, this decision means that their workers are employees that are owed minimum wage protections and overtime protections. And the fact that this is like such a huge deal for them and that they're fighting it so vociferously in the state legislature, to me, signals that they are not paying their workers minimum wage, which is, you know, we've known anecdotally for a really long time. But the amount of energy and money and time that they're putting in fighting this decision is, I think, evidence of the fact that many, many people are not getting minimum wage, that they would be much better under a traditional employment regime where they have access to minimum wage, where they have access to overtime benefits.
Right. And, you know, Lyft did say in its filings for its public offering, it told prospective investors that classifying drivers as employees would, quote, require us to significantly alter our existing business model and would cause what they called monetary exposure, which I think they meant tremendous losses for the company. So they really kind of rely on their drivers not being employees and saving the money that they save from that. But then the cost of them not being employees kind of gets passed on to the public or to taxpayers in many ways, right? Because then, you know, they have to go to the emergency room where they are on food stamps or are in need of more public support.
That's right. And that's what the California Department of Labor has said for a really long time. They've said, look, if companies aren't paying their workers properly, the people that suffer are the people of California who have to pay the taxes to support folks who are working really hard but aren't making enough to survive. And it hurts law-abiding businesses who have to compete with these companies who are operating at an unfair and illegal advantage because they are underpaying their workers.
So these gig economy companies are trying to make the case that requiring them to treat workers as employees would destroy their company, destroy their business, destroy jobs. Can you envision a world in which that ruling happened and what we might see spring up in their wake if in fact it did kind of destroy their business models to some extent?
You know, I wouldn't be surprised if this were true. I studied the taxi industry for a really long time, and what I saw was that the taxi industry has never been profitable absent regulations, absent, you know, a regulatory framework in place. So it might be that, in fact, especially because they're just hemorrhaging money left and right on all kinds of different things that are not traditional to the taxi industry, like trying to invest in self-driving cars, trying to figure out how to use the data analytics that their drivers are constantly collecting, etc. I wouldn't be surprised if forced to actually pay their workers properly, whether these companies would go under. And if that were the case, what I could envision is a really awesome, lots of different things that might be really good for workers and really good for consumers. You know, I think that consumers are really into the idea of having an app that can get them a ride faster than, say, trying to hail a cab or trying to call a dispatch service. And I can also imagine a regulatory regime where you have an app, but you also have a cap on the number of vehicles, you have minimum fares, so that this becomes, you know, possibly could become middle class work again with all of the technological flair of the 21st century. And there's, you know, based on everything that we've known, we've come to know, and all of the solidarity that's been built between and among workers as a result of this ridiculously exploitative regime, I think there's also potential for taxi cooperatives or for driver cooperatives to emerge in that vacuum, which would be, I think, really beautiful and exciting. So, yes, I can see good things emerging if, in fact, this space were to be vacated by these exploitative companies.
Wow, driver cooperatives. I haven't heard that concept in a while, but that's a great note to end on. Vina Dubal, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, our interview with Vina is over, but I just wanted to add a quick recommendation for people who are really interested in this topic. There is an article today in the New York Times entitled "The Backdoor Move Uber and Others Are Using to Shape Labor Rules." It's by Noam Schreiber, who I think listens to our show, or at least I know has at some point. And it's a great unpacking of the kind of legislative, you know, dance that all of these kind of tech-based gig companies are doing across the country to ensure that laws are passed that protect the status of workers as contractors and does not force them to be classified as employees. This is happening in Texas. There's already bills that have been passed in Tennessee, in Indiana, I believe, in Utah, and other places. And of course, it's playing out completely differently here in California. I really recommend people read that to get up to speed on this very, very hot topic, especially as these companies are racing towards multi-billion-dollar IPOs. One final quick break, and then we'll have Don't Close My Tabs, some of the best things we've seen on the web this week.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Okay, Will, let's start with you. What story do you want to share for your tab this week?
All right, I have a bit of potential good news.
Oh!
It's not really news, it's analysis, but but it's not dark and disturbing and grim and hopeless. So that's a little bit of a switch, but this is a story from Wired. It's by Clive Thompson, and the headline is, "We Might Be Reaching Peak Indifference on Climate Change."
Oh, no.
And he borrows the phrase peak indifference from Cory Doctorow, who you might know from Boing Boing.
Yes.
And Thompson cites data showing that the number of Republicans who believe in climate change is up to 64% as of last December, according to a poll from Monmouth University. I would probably want to see a little more data, but Thompson takes this as a very encouraging sign, you know, amid all the terrifying things that are happening around the country and around the world, natural disasters, wildfires, hurricanes, heat and cold. It looks like the message is finally getting through to folks that we've got to do something about this. And that's despite having a president and a Republican leadership that still tries to make the case that climate change isn't a real thing. But his story suggests that we may be moving toward an era where there is finally bipartisan consensus that climate change is real, and we could potentially get on to the business of figuring out together what to do about it rather than having this eternal argument about whether the science is real or some kind of liberal conspiracy.
Yeah, no, it seems like we can't really start to solve things until we can just agree on a baseline there's something that needs to be solved. I should read that. Thank you so much for that recommendation.
Yeah, so April, what's your tab this week?
So I have a piece from Slate, because sometimes we are the band that wears their own T-shirt. This is a fantastic cover story by our frequent contributor, Justin Peters. It is entitled Joe Rogan's Galaxy Brain. And it's about Joe Rogan's galaxy brain. Joe Rogan has, I think, the most popular or one of the most popular podcasts in the country. I mean, just wildly popular. Tons and tons of people listen to him. I think it's weekly. And these are like super long podcasts, and they are incredibly alt-righty, right? But still, like, folks like Elon Musk and Jack Dorsey, I think, has been on there. Alex Jones is a regular guest. And it gets into how these podcasts work and how Joe Rogan operates and why he's perhaps so popular, how he doesn't challenge his guests, and how he's created this very big platform for this kind of like unquestioning type of, it's not journalism, it's just this kind of interview show that pretends to be journalism, where people feel who are in power or who have wild ideas feel really comfortable just kind of saying whatever they want and are not going to be challenged, and has really helped to popularize and present folks like Alex Jones, who are, you know, really parroting these conspiracy theories that do have very dangerous consequences, you know, in the physical world. I don't want to say real world because the internet is real, but you know, about, say, whether Parkland survivors have a hoax, or whether, you know, parents of the victims of the Sandy Hook massacre, you know, whether that was a hoax, and other dangerous conspiracy theories that have really led to harm in the real world. But yeah, Joe Rogan has this incredibly popular podcast. The piece is very, very smart. A lot of satisfying sentences and writing, and just kind of gets a peek into this wildly popular media space that maybe a lot of people who listen to our podcast don't listen to as much, but is really important to understand in terms of really kind of grokking how people who are on the right or near the right really, you know, like to consume their media, or at least what they're consuming.
Yeah, it was a really good piece, I agree. And I thought it did a good job of explaining the appeal of Joe Rogan's show while also sort of dismantling it and explaining why it's not the sort of bastion of free thought and critical inquiry that it sets itself out to be. But it, you know, it seems like Rogan is sort of speaking to this imagined Nixonian silent majority of people who think that the media is too liberal and that people are too quick to take offense. And I thought Peters did a really nice job of capturing why that resonates with people, as well as the ways in which it's actually often very lazy thinking that is presented as either free thinking or as common sense.
Yeah, unchallenging. And my one criticism I just want to add is that it did not get into, and maybe there's just, you know, not enough space and nobody wants to read another 1,000 words. So this isn't criticism as much as something that I would add to the piece or to an argument around this subject, is what led to folks like Joe Rogan gaining popularity and kind of like created a palette or kind of a taste for this type of media, this type of interview. And a lot of that has to do with the deconsolidation that happened. And, you know, throughout the 80s, really in the mid 90s, that led to a tremendous amount of kind of conservative talk radio to blanket the airwaves in the early aughts that I think really paved the way or kind of created an appetite for this type of talk show. And, you know, there's I always think kind of a policy and an economic story here as well that's worth digging into. But a fantastic piece. I'm so happy I read it. I recommend you do, too. And I think that does it for our show this week. Right. That was a lot.
Yeah, it was fun. And I should say, this is usually the part where we say that you can get updates about what's coming up next by following us on Twitter at IfThenPod. We've been really bad at updating that, as you've probably noticed if you've actually ever taken our advice. I don't remember the last time we gave you an update about what's coming up next. So we're going to just go ahead and make that account defunct. And so if you want updates about what's coming up next, do not follow us at If Then Pod. You can follow April and me individually.
And you can also follow Slate Podcast, which is a Twitter account for all of the fantastic shows that Slate hosts. And a lot of the various Slate podcasts are also kind of sunsetting their personal Twitter accounts or their individual Twitter accounts and using this one collective awesome Twitter account, Slate Podcast. Please follow it there. You can reach Will on Twitter, as he said, individually at Will Oremus. I'm at April Laser. Thanks again to our guest, Vina Dubal. I highly recommend you follow her on Twitter. She's at Vina Dubal, especially if you want to track and keep up to date with the politics and the court cases that are raging through the gig worker debate.
And thanks to everybody who's left us a comment or review on Apple Podcasts or whatever platform you use to listen. That is emphatically not defunct. We would still love it if you would go do that if you haven't done that
please.
Already.
If Then is a production of Slate and Future Tense, a partnership between Slate, Arizona State University, and New America. If you want more of Slate's tech coverage, sign up for the Future Tense newsletter. Every week, you'll get news and commentary on how tech advances are changing the world in ways small and large. Sign up at slate.com/future news.
Our producer is Cameron Drews. Thanks to Nick Holmes at Occupy Studios in Newark, Delaware, and Topher Ruth at UC Berkeley for helping us engineer this episode.
Thanks, everybody. Bye.